This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up next is part of an interview that Jim Poplava did with Dr. Gary Schilling, which was featured on this week's FS Insider. And by the way, for a short time only, you can sign up for a 30-day free trial subscription. Just go to the subscribe button on financialsense.com for information or call toll-free 1-888-486-3939. That's either at financialsense.com or call toll-free 888-486-3939. Now here's the interview between Jim Poplava and Dr. Gary Schilling. In a recent edition of the Wall Street Journal, the Journal reported that America's wealth has never been greater, topping over $100 trillion for the first time in history. A lot of that had to do with the real estate market. Joining me on the program is the author of The Age of Deleveraging and the editor-in-chief of A Gary Schilling's Insight, Dr. Gary Schilling. Gary, I want to talk about this month's insight, which is very timely, which you labeled the housing dilemma. So if we look at where housing prices are today, we've recovered a lot of lost ground. We're not quite up to where we were at the peak. So let's begin with that and talk about this upward surge. And are we anywhere near a bubble at this point?
No, I don't think we are. There has been some recovery, but it's been really a mixed bag. The expansion in housing has been mainly at the upper end. And these are people who can afford more housing. And of course, that's in part reflects the income polarization, which has been going on for years in this country, and it's really accelerated since the 2007-2009 Great Recession.
What do you attribute this polarization of income, which is also leading in terms of what we're seeing in the real estate market? Is it because upper income individuals, either they own their own business or they have control of their income versus, let's say, a salaried employee that has to compete with other workers, not only here, but around the globe?
Well, there are a number of causes, but I think globalization, which is what you were just touching on, Jim, is probably the most important one. It has simply transferred a lot of what were high-paid jobs in manufacturing and other areas to Asia, China, and other countries. And it means that a lot of those people have basically been busted down to lower-paying jobs. I mean, the data on this is pretty clear. People who have lost their jobs and get reemployed on average make about 80% of what they made in their last jobs, even if they do find new jobs. And the jobs that are being created in this country are not high-paid jobs, manufacturing, utilities, IT. They're things like retail, trade, and hospitality, desk clerks, roommates, and so on, things that typically are low-paid. And then you've got all this Uberization of people who really trade off the convenience of working the time of day they want, the days of the week they want, for lower pay and very few benefits. So you've got a number of factors going on, the decimation of unionization, particularly in the private sector, a lot of that linked to the loss of manufacturing jobs. But that has held back income for most people, and the people on the top are the ones who can compete in today's globalized world, and they've done very well on balance, but for about 80-90% of Americans, their incomes are, in spending power terms and real terms, they are less than they were 10 years ago.
I want to talk about something that you cover in your newsletter, and that is the changing shape of the real estate market. A lot of individuals lost their homes and became renters in the Great Recession. So we've seen an uptick in apartment construction. And in your view, was that one of the main reasons we have not seen the supply of new homes coming to the market? Because even as of today, the new home supply coming to the market is below what it's been in the past.
Yeah, that's true. What's happened is that construction of apartments has largely recovered to its previous peaks. I mean, they run at annual rate, multifamily starts apartments. They run historically about 300,000 annual rate. In April, latest data, they were actually 370. But then single family, they got up to 1.8 million back in 2006. That was the height of the subprime mortgage bubble, and they've collapsed. They're now about 800,000, and long term, they average about 1.1 million. So it's really been in the single family that you've not seen it. And, of course, the apartment building was a reaction to the fact that a lot of people lost their houses to foreclosure, lost their jobs. They really couldn't afford single-family ownership, and demand for apartments picked up, and that's where people went. The other thing, of course, that happened was that many investors simply bought foreclosed houses, single-family houses, and turned them into rentals. So that's another thing which has really dried up the supply. They simply turned into rentals, and institutional investors who own these, they tend to hold them longer than people who own their single-family house individually. In other words, there's not a turnover in the market nearly to the extent that you had earlier.
You know, I want to stay on that point for a minute because investor ownership has gone from 30% to 34%. And as you mentioned, institutional investors tend to hold on real estate a lot longer. So instead of, you know, flipping the property, because I'm sure they have profits from when they bought it. And that was something that came in this downturn. I can remember, Gary, from 2009 to maybe 2012, hearing about hedge funds, large institutional investors coming in, buying a large swath of real estate, whether it was in Miami, whether it was in Vegas. And that's something, at least in my lifetime, we never saw before, where institutions would come in and buy, hire a property manager, you know, go into an area like Vegas and buy 100 homes.
Yeah. Well, they have. And of course, single family houses are much more maintenance intensive, shall we say, to put it euphemistically, than apartments. You know, apartments, you've got usually one wall exposed to the outside, one outside wall, and that and other things make it a lot cheaper to maintain an apartment building than it does a single family house per unit of living space. So, but nevertheless, they have bought up a lot. Now, some of them are finding that the maintenance is just so expensive, they're not worth it, but still the returns on them, you know, they're running 6 or 7% returns, and relative to what investors can earn otherwise, that's not bad. So a lot of them are simply hanging on to those houses, and they're, in effect, not available. You're not getting the turnover you would have otherwise.
And also, given that interest rates, you know, if we look at 10-year treasuries, they're close to 3%. You talk about the cap rate in real estate is 5.4%. So if I'm an institution, you know, if my rate of return is 5.4% versus what I can get in the bond market, I'm getting a substantial, still, even with appreciating prices, a better return.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, at the same time, the apartment building, there was a big surge, obviously strong demand, and I think it's pretty well caught up. And if you look at the numbers, and we do have them in this June copy of our monthly newsletter, Insight, in relation to people's income, mortgages are cheaper than rents. In other words, things have swung back in favor of home ownership, and first-time buyers are picking up, but it's from a pretty low level.
I want to talk about another factor that is keeping supply from the market. Two factors. One, the boomers are staying in their homes much longer because they need to work, they need to save. And then also millennials, which are, you know, straddled with so much student loan debt. I mean, if you come out of college, what is the average debt is about $29,000-$30,000. You take a married couple, both with that kind of debt, they enter their marriage with $60,000-$70,000 with debt. And the banks are requiring a little bit more down today. We don't have the ninja no-doc loans like we did in the last decade. So explain the demographic factor here and its influence in terms of housing supply.
Yeah, well, they're both supply and demand factors here. You know, the supply side, you've had the houses taken off the market by institutional buyers of single-family houses. You have the concentration on multifamily housing. You've got post-war babies staying in their houses longer. They're working longer. But then on the demand side, you know, as you're pointing out, students have student loans, and a lot of them simply cannot afford the down payments. House prices have risen much faster than incomes for most people. So you have limiting factors on both the supply and the demand side.
The other thing that we've seen in the downturn, a lot of individuals, especially Hispanic, lost their jobs during the downturn. They returned back to Mexico. So there's other things that are driving up the cost. We have rising interest rates, but also lumber, wages, labor. I know building my own home, it took almost 6 months longer because my builder, had a hard time getting people, whether it was electricians, framers, just general contractors, getting the laborers to do the work.
Yes, that's absolutely true. What happened, you go back into the, you know, the 90s and early 2000s, there was a huge rush of Hispanics, particularly Mexicans, who came into this country in the construction trades, plumbers, electricians, masons, and the like. Well, then the housing bubble broke, and a lot of them went home. And they went home because the jobs didn't exist. And also, interestingly enough, birth rates in Mexico dropped. A lot of them didn't need to work in this country and send money home, which they did earlier. And the Mexican economy improved. And of course, at the same time, there's been a tightening up on border crossings. So people from Central America, who were in some sense replacing the Mexicans in the building trades, they have not come in. So you do have, in effect, shortages of skilled labor in this area. And at the same time, you mentioned material costs, lumber prices. Higher lumber prices are adding something like $6,000, the average cost of a house in this country, and so far this year. And a lot of that is, well, last year, the administration put a 20% tariff on imported lumber from Canada. And that's a major source of softwood framing lumber. And also in the Pacific Northwest, there were some devastating forest fires and insect damage, which destroyed millions of acres of timber. So you've had much higher costs, and of course there are higher costs for other areas, steel with the tariffs now on imported steel, cement. You go right across the board and the building costs have increased.
You know, Gary, you mentioned another factor, which is lifestyle changes. And there's two things that you bring up in your newsletter, which I found fascinating. One is the square footage increased, which probably gets back to this income polarization. If you're Larry, lots of bucks, you know, your stock portfolio's up, your income's up, the business revenues, you could probably afford a bigger home. On the other side of it is the millennials, which are choosing a lifestyle to live in high density urban areas, and their desire to own a home isn't as great. I mean, I know as a boomer, when we first got married, our first goal was to, you know, buy and own a home to start a family. It's a little bit different with the younger crowd.
Oh, yeah, it is. I've got a graph in there that shows the rising age of first marriage, the declining fertility rates, the declining birth rates, all these factors. Now, they may catch up. I would assume that a lot of these millennials are not permanently going to be unmarried or not have children, but it'll be later and they'll probably have fewer children. Birth rates are clearly down. So it is a lifestyle. And as you point out, a lot of these people, they prefer to be in urban areas. They like to walk to work, not to get involved in huge traffic jams. So there have been lifestyle changes.
So, I mean, if we're summing this up, as you talk about, on the supply side, we have more investors buying homes, and as they're more from an institutional side, they tend to hold on things a lot longer. The post-war baby boomers are working longer in basically staying in their house. We've got younger individuals like millennials that are more urban-oriented and don't have the money for a down payment. On the demand side, it's hard today with lenders being a lot stricter, requiring 10, 20% down. They just don't have the money. And how much of this is reflected with the gig economy?
Well, it does have an effect on the economy. And let me say that the reason that we wrote this extensive report is because there's so many cries out there, particularly from realtors, oh, there's no inventory to sell, and oh, they're not building single-family affordable houses. And well, I'm really trying to point out in this report that there are very good reasons on both the supply and demand side. But there's also a thing you touch on there is the importance of housing to the economy. Housing is a relatively small sector. On average, long term, it runs 5 or 6% of GDP, the investment in new construction. But it's very volatile. In this last recession, housing, of course, collapsed, and it basically reduced GDP by 4.2 percentage points. Now, the entire recession, peak to trough, declined 4.1 percentage points, one-tenth of a percentage point less. In other words, ex-housing, the economy actually grew a tad. But it's not unusual in recessions for housing to account for a major part of the decline in economic activity. So it's a small but very volatile sector. I think as we look ahead, we're not going to see a huge leap in housing. I think it's gradually improving. As I say, some of these factors are people are advancing in incomes. They're going to get married eventually, I think. The concern about credit scores. You know, a lot of people didn't want to own houses because they remembered for the first time since the 1930s that house prices can and do fall, and they fell during the Great Recession by 34%, peak or trough. Some of those effects wear off, but for housing to go back to the boom where we reached in 2006, I just don't see that. I mean, actually, if you look at home ownership rate, it got up to 69% of people owned their own houses, the rest were renters. It's now about 64%. The long-term average is 65%. We're getting close to long-term average. So I think the recovery in housing, it's still maybe got a little bit further to go, but it's not going to be leaping.
I want to move on to a situation that we find ourselves in, at least, Gary, in my career, I've never seen it. And that is we're towards the end of an aging business cycle. That cycle got extended with, number one, a massive tax decrease. And then on top of that, Congress increased spending by $300 billion. So we're getting fiscal stimulus at the end of a business cycle. At the same time, you have a Fed engaged in a rate raising cycle, and watching the press conference last week when they raised it a quarter of a point, what really struck me is they got rid of 80 words of accommodative language. The dot plot increased to two more rate hikes this year, so four instead of three, and they're eliminating forward guidance. How, in your mind, does this play out? Because we know from the past, 11 out of the last 12 recessions were preceded by rate-raising cycles. And at least in my career, Gary, the only time they managed to lane the plan softly was in 1994. So in your opinion, I'd like to get your take of where this leads.
Well, you're absolutely right. When the Fed starts to raise rates, at least 11 of the 12 times in the post-war period, by my count, they've gotten a recession. The only soft landing, as you point out, was in the mid-90s. And, of course, this time they're not only raising rates, but they're also selling off this huge portfolio. And it started out at $4.5 trillion. It's now $4.4 trillion. They've reduced about $100 billion in the last 6 months. But the point is that they've never had that to do, and their luck in affecting soft landings is so limited with interest rates. And they've used interest rates as their policy instrument for over a century. And now they had a brand new selling off the portfolio. So what are the odds they're going to pull this off without a recession? I'd say very, very low. Having said that, there's so much liquidity sloshing around the world, not only in the U.S., but elsewhere, that in my judgment, it's going to take probably a year or two anyway before they sop up all that excess liquidity and interest rates start to bite to the point that they do precipitate a recession. Now, we were talking about housing earlier, and housing is the most sensitive sector of the economy to interest rates because it's so highly leveraged. I mean, if somebody gets a FHA loan, Federal Housing Authority loan, they can put down 3.5% and borrow the rest.
Wow.
In other words, they are borrowing, 96.5%. I mean, that leverage, if you had that leverage in business, nobody will lend you the money. I mean, it's unbelievably leveraged, so it makes it very interest rate sensitive. But I think for the economy as a whole, we're probably at least a couple of years away from this. Now, the other cause of recession is, of course, a shock. And we saw that in the late 90s when the dot-com bubble broke, and then in the mid-2000s when subprime mortgage bonanza collapsed. And both times you got recessions after that. And we could have that. I don't see any big factors on the immediate horizon. This protectionism, if that gets out of hand, that could be a factor. Of course, you can always get some kind of military blow-up in the Middle East or so on. But there isn't any big bubbles that are just waiting to collapse, in my view.
I want to talk about one of the side effects of Fed raising, and that is what is going on in emerging markets. There's a lot of dollar-denominated loans. We're seeing some of those problems come to fore in Brazil, in Argentina. We've seen it in Turkey, and recently we've had problems in Italy. Is there a risk that if the Fed keeps raising, and I want to get your comment as it applies to treasuries, because the spread between what you can get on a 10-year treasury compared to a German Bund, I've never seen it this wide. So what is the risk that the Fed raises rates too high? Europe is not going to raise theirs, at least they're implying, until next September of 2019, that they precipitate a crisis, but it comes from overseas.
Yeah, well, that is possible. It sort of can the tail wag the dog. The biggest position in portfolios that we manage, and we do manage money, is being long the U.S. dollar. And I think it's benefiting from the safe haven effect, from the effect that the Fed is raising rates before the other major banks. You point out the differential between German bonds and treasuries, you know, about 0.4% on bonds and almost 3% on 10-year treasuries, and that attracts money from abroad and so on and so forth. Now, that strengthening dollar spills over to these emerging markets because they have $1 trillion in foreign loans and three-quarters of them are denominated in U.S. dollars. And as the dollar rallies, it takes more of their domestic currency to service those loans. Also, since most of the world's commodities are priced in dollars, as the dollar goes up, they have to spend more in their local currency, Brazilian reals or Indonesian rupiahs or whatever, to buy commodity imports. So it's very difficult, and that's and again, full disclosure, we're short emerging market stocks and bonds, but that is really a corollary to the strengthening dollar. And it could upset the apple cart, but I think historically, unlike in the late 90s, you know, we had that Asian debt crisis that started in Thailand and then spread throughout Asia, got to Russia, Brazil, Argentina, and so on. It really didn't upset the apple cart. It has much more effect on those economies because they are dependent on the rest of the world for financing. They are dependent on the rest of the world to take their exports, much more so than the reverse.
Jim Poplava and Dr. Gary Schilling, part of a large interview that was featured this week on the Financial Sense Insider Channel. And for a short time only, you can sign up for a 30-day free trial subscription to FS Insider. Go to our subscribe button at financialsense.com for information. Coming up next, Chris Sheridan, Chris Poplava. Emerging market stresses are likely just getting started and likely to get worse as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
What everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Welcome back to the second part of The Big Picture today. By the way, the interview with Dr. Gary Schilling, which Jim Poplava did, was featured on this week's FS Insider. And for a short time only, we have available for you a 30-day free trial subscription so you can hear all of the programs that we run on the FS Insider channel. You can just go to our subscribe button at financialsense.com or call us toll-free at 888-486-3939, 888-486-3939. Coming up next, conversation between Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava about the unwinding of quantitative easing by the Fed and other central banks, which is now putting pressure on the emerging markets, the high-yield debt market, and other vulnerable regions of the globe. An interview from the beginning of the month, which, again, was featured on the FS Insider channel.
Joining us on the show today is the CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. And Chris, I want to note the last time that we spoke with you, we had discussed your second quarter outlook on We Are About to See Who's Swimming Naked. This was a topic that actually just came up with Peter Bookvar, with essentially the idea that we are now starting to see the first casualties of monetary tightening. And I know that that was something that you discussed in depth in your second quarter outlook piece, really looking at the fact that with the monetary tightening, the withdrawal of liquidity, this was going to be a problem and vulnerabilities were likely to emerge in the months ahead. And certainly for 2018, it does appear that we're now starting to see that with emerging markets, Turkey, Italy, and a number of other players as well, even some specific companies, I believe, that are showing signs of stress. Bring us up to speed in terms of your thought process based on what we discussed in your second quarter outlook and where we are today. Do you see that a lot of these players, now that liquidity is being drained from the system, do you see some of those over-leveraged players being revealed? And where do you see things going from here?
You know, it's funny. You don't really know until hindsight who's been swimming naked, as they say, and who the casualty will be. I think, you know, who nailed it right on the head was Fidelity. One of the things I showed in my second quarter newsletter was one of the impacts of, you know, when the tide goes out, one of that being liquidity. And there was a chart that included came from Fidelity Capital Markets Group, and it was showing the QE unwind globally and how that would likely lead to outflows from emerging market equities, emerging market debt, as well as junk bond funds. These were more the risky areas of the financial markets. And the chart they showed had a really great correlation showing the growth in the top four central bank assets over the preceding 12 months, and then what the future 12-month cumulative flows were into those areas, the emerging market debt, equity, and junk bonds. And based on the projections for the Fed cutting its balance sheet, the ECB beginning to taper, and other central banks slowing down, the chart they showed had the top four central banks showing that their cumulative change in their balance sheet was going to peak, and their peak was already in, and it was projecting that the flows into those riskier areas would see its peak in the early part of this year. And I think we've seen that. And based on the projections that we have, we should continue to see outflows from those riskier areas, the emerging market equity, debt, and junk bonds, through the remainder of this year. And one of the things I took a look at was U.S. ETF flows year to date through today. And what we see is that many of the top 10 ETF redemptions are in international equities or junk bonds. The number two one is the iShares MSCI EAFE, that's East Asia Far East ETF. We've seen $7.2 billion has left that fund, which represents 8.6% of its total market cap. And then following that, we've seen iShares Eurozone ETF, that's lost 20% of its market cap. The WisdomTree Hedge Japan ETF has lost 28% of its market cap just year to date. And then we also see the WisdomTree Hedged Europe. We also see the Global High Yield ETF. These were also seeing double-digit outflows of assets from them. And the chart again from Fidelity suggests this is not over, that we are likely to see outflows from these riskier areas through the remainder of this year as the liquidity tide has come out. And those are from those financial markets. And in terms of the debt markets, we've seen that it does appear that emerging markets are under stress. And we could have some more stress there as well as in the junk bond market.
Now, Chris, when we were speaking to Peter Bookvar, one of the open-ended questions was that when we think about the problems in Italy currently with what we saw with the political uncertainty that arose over the weekend, that all of a sudden now there's greater concern by investors over default risk, over Italy leaving the euro, and Spain is also a part of that. So investors are really putting their concern or their attention back onto the European region, but there are a number of other places, some of them you just cited, that are also causing some concern. You know, from your standpoint, how do you assess the impact from those spreading to the wider financial markets, the idea there being contagion? You know, how can you assess whether or not those things are starting to spread and cause ripple effects to the point where the market as a whole is now in danger?
There's several ways that you can look at it. One is essentially the level of confidence that investors have in various markets. And that's expressed in terms of prices. For example, when everyone's very bullish on the stock market, you can see valuations go up in terms of PE ratios. And in terms of the debt markets, it's what investors are wanting to be compensated for the level of risk they're willing to take. And when investors become worried about the liquidity issue or solvency for a corporation or even a sovereign country, they demand higher interest rates to be compensated for that risk. And we see that. What's really come to light in the last week or so is Italy. As early as a few weeks ago, Italy's two-year debt had a negative yield, and that ballooned north of 2.5% in a blink of an eye. That shows you how quickly confidence can be eroded. We saw that back in 2010 when interest rates on Greek debt were below 5%. And then within a few matter of months, we saw, you know, some of their short-term yields north of 50%. Essentially, they were being priced for bankruptcy until the ECB came in and bailed them out. So one of the ways to look for the spread of contagion risk is rising rates in sovereign bonds. And as of right now, we do see a flight to safety where Italian yields have gone up, but we've seen French and German yields go down. So we see that money is leaving Italy and going to the safer areas of the Eurozone. But outside of that, we are seeing stress in other countries, particularly in Latin America, in Chile, in Argentina, Venezuela. And we're also seeing in other parts of Europe, such as Turkey, where we're seeing yields moving up and their currencies moving down. Now, the problem with that, not just having their yields go up, but the other issue is a falling currency, because a lot of times foreign corporations and governments, they issue debt denominated in dollars. So if you think about borrowing, let's say, $100 million debt that you've issued, and you're pricing that in dollars, well, what happens if, let's say, you're paying a 4% coupon, but you're having to pay that in your local currency, and then your local currency falls 50%? Well, now that 5% cost to you really feels like 10%, because you're having to use more currency to convert to dollars. So that is part of the reason why I feel we're seeing the stress, is there's really a couple of issues going on that is hurting the global economy. We're seeing interest rates rise globally. We're seeing inflation pick up globally and commodity prices picking up. At the same time, liquidity is beginning to be drained by central banks in terms of slowing down QE, or at least here in the U.S., we've gone from QE to QT, quantitative tightening, by shrinking the balance sheet. So I think all of these things are having an impact, and one of the big ones that we're seeing now is a rising dollar. You know, the world transacts in dollars. As I mentioned, a lot of corporations and governments issue dollar-denominated debt. So when you have a surging dollar, that creates problems. The last time we saw this was from 2014 to 16. When the dollar surged, we saw commodities collapse, and we saw significant stress in emerging markets that had dollar-denominated debt, plus those that export commodities. Brazil, their currency fell over 50%. We had issues in Saudi Arabia and Russia. All these countries were suffering from falling commodity prices. And going back even further, if you look in the 1990s, when the dollar was significantly strong during that period, we saw the Asian currency crisis and the collapse of long-term capital management and the Russian ruble. So that's my concern. And one of the things I was arguing was that we would likely see our third global growth slowdown. And typically when you see growth slow, people begin to be scared and they go into safety, which is what we typically see them going into U.S. treasuries and the U.S. dollar. That only adds fuel to the fire. When the dollar strengthens, that creates even more stress. So in my humble opinion, I think we're in the early innings of this, because as you and I were speaking in our last conversation, prior to Italy kind of making the news, the world and commentators were still talking about the phenomenal global synchronized growth that we are undergoing. So that's looking in the rearview mirror, and we're looking forward at what lies ahead. And given that was the consensus, I still think we're in the early innings of this.
You know, one thing that you mentioned, I remember back in 2005, that you were tracking very regularly at our company with the housing bubble and how that was spreading with the credit erosion in the mortgage market into the other markets, and was one reason of many that you were very worried that, you know, we were going to see a major peak in the markets and that we were going to see a pretty steep credit crisis that was going to result from that, was because of tracking credit default swaps on various companies and seeing how those ripple effects from the mortgage industry were working into the financial industry and just the level of risk that was there. And you were writing pieces at the peak of the market in 2007, telling investors to prepare, to watch out below, the worst is yet to come, when many commentators were still talking about it being a Goldilocks economy. You know, I think about the current economic minister that was appointed by Trump on CNBC, I believe it was, you know, talking about how we were in this Goldilocks economy, recession, making fun of people, recession. And here you were saying, hey, things are going to get really bad. But again, all this to say that, you know, you were looking at credit default swaps on a number of different companies, tracking that and seeing how that was moving through the system. What do you see currently in the credit default swap universe as far as contagion risk or certain areas that are seeing some of the impacts from Italy and perhaps even emerging market areas?
I am seeing signs that stress is beginning to build, and in some areas it's increasing rapidly. The idea behind a growth slowdown is when growth slows, think of a corporation, you're earning less, think of a consumer, there's more that are possibly being laid off, you're probably not getting as many pay raises when growth slows down, Also, when you think of rising commodity prices, which typically choke growth, consumers are paying more at the pump. You have corporations which are paying more for their input costs. And in terms of the government, government tax revenue typically falls or at least slows down during growth slowdowns. And so when growth slows, you know, you feel the pain. And those who are leveraged, who are just barely cutting it, when growth moves the other way, you see the signs of stress in those who are most levered. And one of the things that I'm looking at is a good sign of that in terms of Europe are European banks. If you look at Deutsche Bank, their stock price is fell below $11 a share today, and it's closing in on its lows of 2016. We had a phenomenal growth boom from 2016 to the early part of this year, and we saw, you know, Deutsche Bank rally, I think, roughly about 100%, and just in a couple of months, it's given all of that back. And when you look at the stress that they're showing, their credit default swaps have gone up tremendously. At the height of the slowdown in 2016, credit default swaps and Deutsche Bank debt reached 250 basis points. And they're now at 157. And in the beginning of this year, they were as low as roughly around 60 or 70. So they've gone up vertically, as has Italy. Italy is at 268 basis points. And at the height of the euro crisis in 2011-2012, they were at 550. So, you know, at the low recently this year, they were at 100. So we've gone up, you know, we've already doubled and looking at tripling from the present level. So I'm definitely seeing signs of stress. I don't think it's as high as it was in 2016 or let alone 2010 and 2011. And that's why I think we still have more ways to go. Because again, about a month ago, everyone was talking about how great growth was. No one was talking about a growth slowdown. And I still don't think you are. Hearing other investment advisors and commentators, it still shows me where the consensus is. And I think we've got more to come. And part of that has to do with how much debt is maturing. It reminds me somewhat similar to the housing crisis that we had here in the U.S. We had a tremendous amount of mortgages that were issued that had adjustable rates. And while you could barely afford your home at a low teaser rate, as soon as rates reset, you felt that pinch. We started having foreclosures. Well, think of it from the sovereign market. Over the last 8 years or so, there's been a gradual decline in interest rates. And so a lot of corporations and sovereign governments have been able to issue a tremendous amount of debt at very low rates. Well, globally, we've been seeing rates rise. And particularly when your country shows signs of stress, your yields go up as investors demand more compensation for risk. The concern that I have is the amount of debt that is going to be coming due progressively from here through the remainder of the decade. We're seeing higher debt maturing this year than we did last year. And we'll see even more in 2019 and even more in 2020. So there is an article that Bloomberg had just talking about the emerging market stress is just beginning, mainly because of how much debt is coming due. But one of the things they looked at was the amount of debt coming due between now through the end of 2019. And we have roughly, in terms of China, we have about, and this is dollar-denominated debt that is maturing, we've got nearly $100 billion of dollar-denominated debt coming due in China. Number two, we've got Brazil north of $20 billion, Mexico north of $20. Argentina, which is in a complete collapse, is north of $20 billion. And we've got Russia, which is roughly over $10 billion. So we have a lot of countries with tons of dollar-denominated debt that's going to be coming due. And it's coming due at a period where interest rates have spiked. So not only are they going to have to issue new debt, and hopefully investors will come to the table to buy the debt, but they're going to be issuing debt at higher interest rates, which means they're going to be in a more difficult financial position going forward from here on out. And that's why I think we're still in the early stages of this potential slowdown, which I think is going to become the narrative and replace the whole synchronized global growth narrative. I think the global growth slowdown will become the new narrative.
Chris, when we spoke with you last time, you gave us a bit of a short-term outlook for how you see the markets progressing. And one thing that we discussed was the amount of corporate buybacks. And I think many of our listeners now know, if they've been listening to our program, is that, you know, we saw a record number of buybacks. And I think that they are expected to be an all-time high for this year in particular. And you had essentially just pointed out that that's having a major impact on the market. A lot of them are coming from tech companies. If you look at the top 10 different companies that are going to be doing the most buybacks, most of them are tech. Apple, I think, is at number one. Essentially, what you said is that around earnings periods, there is a blackout period and companies cannot buy back their shares. But then once that blackout window expires, after all the earnings have come through, then they can go back in and buy their stock in mass. That's what we've been seeing. That did drive the market up from the last time we spoke to you, but give our listeners an update. Where are we at in this process again? When is the next blackout window, and how do you see this affecting the market?
Well, if you look at where corporations, the rules that guide them in terms of how they can buy back their shares, typically it's several weeks before and after their earnings announcement where they are precluded from buying. And so when you think of the end of the quarter, we should start to see earnings releases beginning late June into early July. And during that time period, we're going to start to see more and more companies being prevented from buying back their stock. And that's part of the reason why when you and I last spoke, I felt that this recovery rally we were having was from corporate buybacks, where companies were coming out of their blackout period and finally able to buy their shares. And they were able to do so well off the January high. So that was from an entry point. That was a decent buying opportunity. And so that's why I think we aggressively saw the market rally, you know, in May and then in the latter part of April, was because of corporations coming out of these blackout periods. Now, as we enter into the next blackout period, I have a feeling that that would mark the top in the markets, as one of the big buyers of equities this year will be moved to the sidelines. At the same time, I think we're going to start seeing more momentum of a growth slowdown beginning to percolate into the financial media, which will then weigh on investors. You know, there was really three consensus views going into this year. And often at times when everyone is on one side of the ledger, typically the opposite happens. And going into this year, the idea was that growth would continue in terms of global growth. And based on the rest of the world growing, that the dollar would remain weak because of the growth differential from emerging markets and developed nations relative to the S-Wiss closing. And the idea was that the dollar would be weak, global growth would continue. And then the third thing was that interest rates would be rising and bonds would be down this year. Now, my contentions is that we would have the opposite. We'd have a growth slowdown. And typically when you have a growth slowdown, you see dollar strength. And the other thing that we have often seen during slowdowns is interest rates would fall. So in my opinion, I think that we will see over the summer falling equities, a rising dollar, and falling interest rates and rising bond prices. And the concern, and I think, again, I keep talking about where the narrative is shifting. One of the things that I think will become a very big topic this summer is the potential for an inverted yield curve. If you look at where a two-year Treasury note is right now, the two-year U.S. Treasury is yielding 2.4%. The 10-year is at 2.8. So there's roughly about a 0.4 difference between the two and the 10-year Treasury. I believe that we could see the 10-year yield drop down to close to 2.5%. If it does that, we're going to be virtually having a flat yield curve, where there might be some parts of the yield curve that actually do invert. And so when you think about an inverted yield curve, that is definitely going to spark some concern and anxiety in the markets, and it's likely to get a lot of coverage by the financial press. That in itself could create fear that would drive the markets even lower. So, you know, we're not there yet. I think that's still ahead of us, why I feel this is the time to be defensive. But my feeling is that if we do have a growth slowdown, one of the things that I'm concerned about that we might see later this year is that the European Central Bank is slated to end its QE program. I believe it's by September of this year. Now, if we have a growth slowdown, if Italy really comes to the surface, as well as possibly Spain, then what we might see is that the ECB says, you know what, we're not going to end QE, we're going to actually extend it into 2019. That would then take away a lot of strength from the euro, and we could see the euro weaken even further to the dollar. And that could really turbocharge a dollar rally, which would then even exacerbate further the stress that we see in those who have dollar-denominated debt. So I think we've got a lot of potential landmines ahead of us, and I think all of this will eventually cause the Federal Reserve to stop raising interest rates, I believe, this year. I think 2018 will be the final rate hike of this cycle. You know, there's a lot of estimates going to this year. They would raise four times this year, 3 to 4 times next year. That's the consensus. And I think if I'm right, and what I think could happen does play out, this might be the final rate hike that we see for the Fed is this year. And when that happens, where the Fed itself says, you know what, we're done tightening, we do see signs of slowing, that could then lead to a significant rally in the price of gold. Gold could be kind of sniffing out that the tightening cycle is over, and that could lead to, you know, significant rally in gold, which is why I think gold, despite a dollar rally, has held up relatively well. You know, it can provide some protection in geopolitical uncertainty, some type of financial stress. So gold for me is, I'm watching gold for a possible entry point later this year.
Well, Chris, I want to note that when we spoke to you earlier this year on the game plan for late cycle investing, that was an article that you had written at the time. I believe that was your first quarter outlook. You know, one of the things that you had discussed in there is that we are likely to see an increased amount of volatility in the market, that inflation was going to continue to pick up, and that with those two forces and with the idea that we're now starting to see this slowdown in the economic cycle, you had also mentioned on our show that we've seen now a peak in the Financial Sense leading economic indicator, that has been trending down. So when we put all these things together, you know, investors want to be reducing risk on some of the more cyclical areas of their portfolio, and they want to be thinking about adding more into commodities. And since we spoke with you then about that, that has definitely been good advice. If we think about, you know, energy stocks as a hedge, if we think about commodities and materials and a number of things that we discussed, those have been outperformers, moving from underperformers to outperformers. And so I would take it that that is still the game plan that you have in place.
That is true. You know, I think right now is the time to play defense. I think later this year, when things are possibly at their apex in terms of a growth slowdown and fear and anxiety is at elevated levels, that's probably when the Fed will hint that they may be over. And typically when the Fed has its last rate hike, you still have some runway left in the financial markets, because it's seen as a sign by investors that the Fed isn't going to take away the punch bowl from the party. But essentially, Fed policy impacts the markets and economy with a lag. So even though the Fed does end raising interest rates, we typically still see often at times that their rate hikes have led to a recession. So when we see the Fed raise the last time, we typically see the markets rally. And oftentimes that rally is the last rally of the bull market. So if I'm right that the Fed does end its rate raising cycle this year, we could see our final move higher in the equity markets later this year, going into early next year, to put in the final top. So, you know, overall, I think there's a lot of risk out there. There's a lot of uncertainties. You know, we've seen what happened last year with the Trump tax stimulus plan. Certainly things can change, but absent any significant change, that's kind of the roadmap that I'm laying out for our clients.
Well, Chris, with that said, I do want to note that you invest according to the data, not according to theories. And it's nice that you have developed a lot of really valuable indicators for tracking where things are at and the leading relationships, whether or not we're talking about LEIs, whether or not we're talking about Fed monetary policy impact that that is having. So you have developed a wide range of extremely valuable tools for risk management and knowing where we are in the economic cycle, many of which we publish on our site and talk about on our program. So kudos to you on your ability to utilize Bloomberg to its fullest. With that said, if you wouldn't mind, tell our audience a little bit about Financial Sense Wealth Management, the services that we offer, and the best way that they can get in contact with you.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we cover the full gamut of financial services, whether we're looking at investment management, financial planning, insurance needs, and they can give us a call to look and discuss their personal situation. Our toll-free number is 888-486-3939, or they can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
Well, Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you. We look forward to having you on again.
Thanks, Chris. Look forward to it.
So once again, that was Chris Paplava, Chief Investment Officer, Financial Sense Wealth Management. And as he mentioned in the opening there, speaking of the Fidelity chart that we discussed earlier this year, they were showing that the QE unwind that we're seeing across the major four central banks was projecting funds to move away from the high risk areas of the market, including emerging markets and then also high yield debt. And if you look at the chart, which I'll have where this interview is located on Financial Sense, if you want to check it out for yourself, essentially it shows a major peak late 2017, early 2018. And if you remember, that was when we saw the peak, not just in the US markets, but in a range of other markets as well. So that was a very prescient chart showing the tight correlation that we see between central bank balance sheets and fund flows into various areas. And that chart is still projecting that fund flows are going to continue to be moving away from those high risk areas, emerging markets, high yield debt in particular. And so that was what Chris shared with us today, essentially talking about how we have seen some default risks perk up now with Italy, Spain. When we think about the amount of leverage that those economies have, some of the recent elections and how that's putting investors' focus back onto risks on those areas, even though they never went away. It just means now that we see liquidity shrinking by the central banks, that is monetary tightening. Now that we see the dollar increasing, that makes dollar denominated debts held abroad more expensive and harder to pay back. So all of these things now are becoming more of a concern. And so from our perspective, as Chris said, you know, you can look at a number of things. You can look at borrowing costs, that is interest rates on various countries' debt. If those are increasing from Italy into Spain, and then even to other areas as well, that's one way that you can see contagion spreading or default risk spreading to other areas. Another thing that you can look at are credit default swaps. And as I noted, Chris was pointing to those very regularly in 2007 and all the way into the downturn that we saw in 2008, pointing out that credit default swaps were spiking on large mortgage companies and that that was spreading into the financial industry. So he was very prescient in seeing the 2008-2009 credit crisis well before, you know, mainstream news. And even when people were still talking about us being in a Goldilocks economy, looking at credit default swaps was extremely timely and prescient tool or indicator to have on your dashboard. So that's one thing that you can also look at to see what level of risk we're seeing in the markets and how that's spreading from market to market. So wrapping all this up, Chris said that if we look at stock buybacks and also Fed rate hikes, there is a good case to be made that we're going to see another run in the market, perhaps later this year, and that will be the final peak if the Fed decides that they are going to finally go on pause. And also when we think about how stock buybacks are influencing the market, I mean, you got to keep in mind some of these companies, which are the largest in the world, Apple included, Google, many tech firms, I mean, they are buying back record amounts of their shares. And in some cases, they're the main buyer out there. So that is helping to lift their stock prices up and the indices altogether. So when we enter that next blackout period, that is going to be a pretty good thing to watch to see what sort of effect that's going to be. We did see that put pressure on the market in the past. So this is going to be a more reliable metric to follow going forward in terms of its influence, since they are such large players now. And lastly, for the game plan for late cycle investing, as we discussed with Chris earlier, Chris is still holding to the view that investors want to be reducing risk and thinking about diversifying into those sectors of the market that do well as you move into that later portion of the business cycle, which we believe we are now in. If you haven't read that quarterly newsletter that we sent out earlier, I will have a link to that with a number of different charts that were discussed in today's interview. So feel free to browse through those. If you have any questions for me or Chris Poplava, definitely feel free to email us. My email address is cris@financialsense.com. And you can also give us a call at the number or email that Chris provided for himself.
Before we go today, I'd like to remind everybody that the interviews you just heard, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava, as well as Jim Poplava's interview with Gary Shilling, were originally featured on our FS Insider channel. And for a short time only, you can sign up for a 30-day free trial subscription. All you have to do is go to the subscribe button at financialsense.com for information, or call toll-free 1-888-486-3939. That's go to the subscribe button at financialsense.com or call us 888-486-3939. Well, Jim, that's it for a rather busy show today, I would say. What are we looking forward to in the weeks to come? Anything special?
Well, like I said, the two big events in the month of June
where what was going on with the Fed, we now found the Fed is now going to be leaning against the economy, more likely to get 4 rate hikes unless something happens. And then, of course, the OPEC meeting on Friday, where they're going to increase production less than they expected. Heck, that's not even going to cover what could happen to Venezuelan oil production. But we're going to be heading into Q2 earnings season. That will begin in full next month. So everybody's going to be taking a look at, will the earnings be as strong as they were in the first quarter, where they're up almost 24%. So we'll be watching that. And we're also going to be watching the LAIs. This is the first half of the year. The first quarter was less than expected on the economic growth front. It was a little over 2%. Now they're saying we could be heading to 3 or even 4%. Usually the second and third quarters are the strongest performing quarters of the year when it comes to economic growth. So we'll be looking at that and much, much more. But we're heading right into corporate earnings season in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here in the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.